Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com. Once there was darkness, and then there was light. Once human beings lived in a state of superstition and savagery, enslaved by magic and the doctrines of the Catholic Church. And then, beginning in the salons of 18th century France, a group of thinkers in wigs led them out into the light of reason, science, revolution, and the guillotine. That's the traditional... That's the traditional explanation of the Enlightenment. Anyway, and I'm joined by my very own Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a man of chilly, cerebral faith, Tom Holland. Tom, was that a fair description of the Enlightenment, do you think?
Well, you could almost have been describing the Protestant Reformation, of course.
I could, yes. Well, we'll go on to say, won't we, whether they are different or not.
Well, yes. I know that... I'm kind of nervous about what I'm about to say, because I know that certain listeners to the podcast have begun the a drinking game in which huge amounts of alcohol have to be drunk if I mention Christianity. But essentially, the mythology of the Enlightenment is that it's an emancipation, not just from the Catholic Church, but from Christianity and religion, full stop.
Yes.
Whereas I think that that is a myth. And the reason that, I point out that your description of the Enlightenment could equally have applied to the Protestant Reformation, and indeed with certain kind of provisos with how Christianity saw itself against the context of pre-Christian paganism, is that I think that the Enlightenment is best understood as one of the great mutational processes in the history of Christian Europe.
And Western thought, Tom. I mean, it's bigger than just Christian Europe, isn't it?
Well, I'm not sure about that. What Christians do is to say that there was darkness and then there was light. The people who walked in darkness have seen a great light.
Yeah.
And the darkness is equated with paganism. What the Protestants do is to equate the darkness with, the Romish Church, popery, and Reformation is about bringing people into light. It's about toppling superstition. It's about banishing idols. What the Enlightenment does is to cast the whole sweep of Christian history as the darkness, and to essentially identify philosophy as the... I see you waving at me.
I am, because I'm conscious that some people won't know what the Enlightenment was. So I think you are the master of this. You should give a 90-second overview of the dates, some of the characters. What are we talking about here? Because the people, even at the time, they used the word enlightened a lot. So we're talking 18th century. But there's never really been an agreed definition of where it happened, or indeed when it happened.
No, so it's incredibly difficult. But one of the things about the Enlightenment that does set it apart, say, from the Reformation, is that there were people living through it who identified it as the name the Enlightenment comes from the 18th century.
Yes.
And it's such a kind of mythologized period, because essentially for lots of people today, the Enlightenment stands as the kind of fountainhead of their sense of their identity. So the Enlightenment is often equated with kind of good things that liberal people feel about themselves.
Yeah.
So the Enlightenment values. I'm a defender of Enlightenment values. It's generally,
It's the sort of thing that columnists say. Yeah,
yes, absolutely. I think that to see the Enlightenment, to equate the Enlightenment as it existed in the late 17th, early and 18th century with, modernity, with the fruits of liberal secular democracy as we have it now, is simply wrong. Because I think it's much more complicated than that. And the complexity of it is what makes it so slippery a subject to define.
Well, what you've done you've basically refused to give the dates.
Okay, well, I would say that I would date it from 1660. I would identify it with Spinoza.
Do you know, Tom,
Do you know the date I have written down in my notes here?
1660?
1660. But I've written it down because the foundation of the Royal Society.
Well, that shows how much more cosmopolitan I am than you.
Why do you hate Britain? That's my question.
I don't hate Britain. I love the Dutch.
Oh, no, don't give me all that. So let's say mid to late 17th century to that, I guess we would agree. Yeah, the French Revolution is generally taken, the advent of Napoleon. Napoleon is often described as the last enlightened despot. So, it's a sort of, it's a ferment of ideas, isn't it? And that sort of cliched description that I gave at the beginning of men in wigs and salons, I mean, that is a huge part of it. It's about clubs, coffee houses, literary salons, people like Voltaire and Diderot, traveling across Europe, exchanging ideas, writing books, a very literate public, and this sort of sense of intellectual excitement, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, and there are incredible varieties. So I think on the continent, it's much more court-based.
Yeah.
And I think in the Netherlands and in England, it's much more sociable. But I think in both cases, the it's kind of fun. I think there's, with a lot of the kind of the key Enlightenment thinkers, you have a sense that these are people who are really enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
There's a kind of sense of excitement about it. And absolutely, the kind of sociable quality of it is absolutely fundamental. And the philosophes see themselves as...
So the philosophes are these French thinkers.
Yeah, identifying themselves with the philosophers of ancient Greece. They see themselves as... well, it's just kind of, a class apart. They see themselves as people leading the way into light out of darkness. And therefore, they are not in any way modest people.
Well, that brings up Fordek's question, one of our listeners. And he or she, I don't know why I assume a man would call himself Fordek. It just seems like a more stereotypically, I imagine him as a reader of the Patrick O'Brien novels, which you foolishly despise. Anyway, Fordek says, was it really that big a deal? And was it? That's the key question, really. So why does it matter? Why is it a big deal?
I think it matters. I mean, I think it's of seismic significance, and not just for Europe or for America. I mean, I think the United States is inconceivable without the Enlightenment. But because of the impact of Europe and the United States on the world, it's of global significance. And in a way, it matters because. Although I think it's very culturally contingent, I think it's bred very, very specifically of the particular cultural circumstances of Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries. It's brilliant at disguising itself as universal. So Voltaire, who's probably the most famous of all the Enlightenment figures, he says of the church fathers that they thought the whole world should be Christian and that therefore they were necessarily the enemies of the whole world until it was converted. And he saw himself as being superior to that. But actually, of course, Voltaire and the philosophes were doing exactly the same. And enthusiasts for Enlightenment values tend to feel exactly the same way, that the entire world should be converted to Enlightenment values. But because they're able to kind of cast it as somehow universal. Again, Voltaire talks about there being a commonality of intellectuals from Peking to Cayenne, famously, he's able to pass off this very, very kind of European, West European phenomenon as being universal. But anyway, I mean, what do you think? How would you identify the Enlightenment?
Well, it's a massive question. So I think there's a very famous historian of it called Jonathan Israel, and he argues that it's all about ideas. And he says it's not out of circumstances, it's out of the ferment of ideas, so you shouldn't, or that the social and economic context have been overplayed. But I think the social and economic context are massively important. So I think, it's post... Europe has gone through the wars of religion after the Reformation.
So there's a question from Mark Taylor.
Yeah.
To what extent was it a reaction to the excesses of the early 17th century?
I think it is a reaction. I think there's a huge element of that. So, I mean, we've talked before about the English Civil War, obviously Ireland, Scotland, the horrific impact of the 30 Years' War in Central Europe. And I think you can see generally a sort of, the next couple of generations they're not traumatized is too strong, but they're very strongly affected, influenced by that. There's a reaction against it. But also this is an age of sort of mercantilism, trade, printing, obviously an explosion of printing.
So, and literacy.
Yeah, literacy going up. So I think something like by the end of the 18th century, about 60% of English men and women, of English men rather, could read and write. I think a smaller percentage of women. So there's just far more readers and writers. And I think the other thing that we haven't, the word we haven't mentioned is science, really. And I think science, the idea of the world as a machine with laws, Kepler and his observing the kind of planetary motion, obviously Newton is massive. I mean, Newton is a colossal Enlightenment figure, I think, because everybody had read him, everybody knew about his ideas. And this idea that, this idea of the world as a kind of watch. I read a brilliant book actually a few weeks ago about clocks in history. Did you see this? By a guy who's the curator of the Greenwich sort of observatory and stuff. And this is the key point, really, when people are making clocks and they're obsessed by this idea of the world as a clock. And is there
God
a watchmaker?
As the watchmaker.
God as the watchmaker. And you can understand how it works. And I think that's something, all those ideas.
But, you know, on that topic, a brilliant thing. So Voltaire.
Yeah.
He settles in Geneva. And he also has a place at Ferney across the Swiss-French border. And in the late years of his life, he wants to plough something back in. So he sponsors people in Switzerland to manufacture watches.
Does he?
Yeah. So he becomes a watchmaker.
He becomes
he's the presiding watchmaker.
Where Voltaire led, casts himself Rolex as God. Followed.
Yeah. Or where God had led.
Yeah. That's yeah, but I think this all, the other thing that strikes me about the Enlightenment, and maybe you'll say that this is nothing new, but you get a real sense of, you could argue this is where the sort of the citizens of nowhere started. So you've got kind of Voltaire and Diderot and all these French guys who are traveling to Russia and stuff, and actually spend a lot of their lives, Voltaire obviously, in exile. And they see themselves as part of a republic of letters. You know, they're not bound by nationality. By the narrow loyalties of the past.
Well, but also by religious identification.
Yes. Well, I tell you what's really interesting. There's so much sort of swapping of identities. So Rousseau, he was a Calvinist, wasn't he? And then he becomes a Catholic, converts to Catholicism, I think. And Gibbon is sent to Geneva, I think it is, or certainly sent to Switzerland, because he has been flirting with converting to Catholicism. So these are people who are beginning to sort of, I don't want to lapse completely into the 21st century and say their identities are fluid, but they're certainly more fluid than they would have been 100 years previously. And they see themselves as part of a cosmopolitan, they self-consciously see themselves as part of a sophisticated cosmopolitan community, don't they?
I mean, I think that the 18th century is a period of massive religious ferment. So you've got kind of incredible revival processes going in the Catholic Church. You've got Methodism, you've got the Great Awakening in a evangelical process. And I think that the Enlightenment is best seen as a further kind of expression of that seismic attempt to make sense of the world. And I think it does absolutely exist in the context of the traumas and the carnage and the horror of the religious wars of the 17th century. And it's often today that process is often cast as a kind of process of discovery of toleration. I think that mistakes it. I think that basically what people are after is to try and find a kind of what they would call a civil religion, a way of a religious settlement that will promote kind of stability, civilized living, virtuous citizenship, all these kind of things. And how you get there, you know, is contested, but it's not so contested that people are going to fight over it. And in a way, that is the fact that you can travel, you know, as Voltaire does to Protestant, the Protestant Dutch Republic, to Protestant London, to Frederick the Great, likewise Protestant, Geneva, that is absolutely fundamental to Voltaire's sense of himself.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's all true. But I think a key part of it is this idea of light and darkness. Graham Bradbeer has a question. Who decided and when that it should be given the name the Enlightenment? Now, Tom, this is mean of me because I know that, because I looked this up beforehand and you didn't. So
yeah, go on. So give it to us.
It's a man called Jubeau, a Frenchman, who used the word lumière, talked about les lumières, the lights. But actually, that the idea of light and darkness, I know you're going to have loads to say about this, but I'll just say this. You see this again and again. So Kant talks about, Immanuel Kant, the great German thinker, talks about Aufklärung, kind of, I don't know, clearing of light or whatever. You see people talking again and again about light, obviously the secret society, the Illuminati, very Enlightenment group. But also, I always think the great Enlightenment paintings are those paintings which I know you all know and lots of listeners will know, by a guy called Joseph Wright of Derby. And the most famous one, Experiment on a Bird and an Air Pump, 1768. You can look it up online. An amazing painting. And people are all looking around and they're surrounded by darkness and shadows. And from the experiments, there's this sort of fantastic glow of light. And that's how people thought of themselves in the 18th century. They thought what has gone before was darkness and shadow and superstition. And we are leading the world into light. And I think key to the sense of the Enlightenment is a sense that before that, the previous 1700 years were all about darkness and night and sort of foolishness and ignorance. Now, I'm sure you will say that that is based on a colossal and utterly misleading stereotype, won't you?
No, but because I think that...
No.
I think a sense that that people are in darkness and they have to be brought into light has been a kind of abiding theme of European civilization.
Yeah, but they thought that that was that people in 1200 or something were living in darkness. But you don't think they were living in darkness, do you? I mean, you don't. You're not one of these people who, because some people say, "Oh, before the Enlightenment, all was medievalism and foolishness, and they, you know, people lived in huts and daubed themselves with mud, and they was didn't care about science." And that's obviously rubbish to my mind. I think there was lots of science. There was lots of intellectual experiments and discovery.
I think there's almost nothing about the Enlightenment that doesn't have medieval roots. And I would say, you know, what I'm saying is that the very idea of seeing of worrying that people are in darkness and they need to be brought into light is absolutely
constant.
The 12th century reformers, that's exactly what they're doing. You know, it's the 12th century reformers who come up with the word modernitas, the idea that modernity is equated with light. You know, this isn't something that's invented in the 18th century.
Yeah.
It has its roots in the process of reform in the 12th century.
But they come to believe that they've invented it, and that idea has lasted. So people now, you know, you'll open The Guardian or The Times, and there'll be a column saying, well, we're standing for Enlightenment values against the medieval barbarism of the Taliban or whoever.
Yes,
so in other words, we've completely imbibed that Enlightenment sense of itself, and we don't even question it now.
Well, but I think that there have been three great convulsive processes where the ambition of kind of intellectual elites to reform the world has generated a revolutionary process. One of which is the 11th and 12th century, where essentially you get the medieval church, the Roman church. And I would say that Catholics today still look back to that as, you know, an exemplification of darkness being banished by light.
Okay.
You have it with the Reformation, and I would say that believing Protestants likewise would see the Reformation as absolutely a process of enlightenment. And then you have what we call the Enlightenment, and I would say that kind of liberal, secular, atheist, agnostic, whatever, look back to the Enlightenment. So those three processes seem to me absolutely, you know, they are obviously, each one in turn is a reaction to what has gone before, but they also are obeying very, very similar and identifiable rhythms.
So repeating the formulas, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so that raises Owen Williams's question. What he says, what did the Enlightenment do for Western intellectual progress that the Renaissance didn't? And that's a really good question, because I was thinking, tell you who I was thinking about. I was thinking about Shakespeare. So Shakespeare is obviously a Renaissance figure, but in some ways he feels like a very kind of proto-Enlightenment figure as well, doesn't he? He's got a sense of himself clearly as part of a wider, sophisticated European orbit. He's looking back to the classical world. There's lots of stuff about kind of, you know, he's obviously thinking through things. Somebody like Hamlet is using the power of reason. So Shakespeare does seem a very proto-Enlightenment figure, even though we wouldn't put him in that. So is there a difference, Tom, between the Enlightenment and the Renaissance? And is the Enlightenment doing something different?
But again, the Renaissance is an incredibly slippery term. And what we call the Renaissance, you know, kind of whatever, 15th century Florence. The idea of looking back to the classical world and finding things there that are worthy of bringing back to life is something that's going on, you know, at least from the time of Charlemagne. And, you know, so in a sense, the Enlightenment is a process of Renaissance, because you have, you know, the way in which many of the leading Enlightenment figures, in their kind of ambition to shove Christianity to one side, claim to be the heirs, say, of Socrates or whoever, is another form of Renaissance.
But there is, okay, I accept that this is a whole massive continuum, and that, you know, we just are dividing it up slightly artificially and putting labels on it. But people at the time had a sense of ferment, didn't they? They had a sense of time, intellectual history accelerating, and a sense of ideas being swapped in a way they weren't being swapped before, and that they're living into. That's why they talk about themselves as Les Lumières, as enlightened. It's why there's a particular kind of vocabulary, isn't there? I mean, even Edmund Burke, who's often seen as a sort of counter-Enlightenment figure because he's the father of conservatism, talks about, when he writes to the electors of Bristol, and he says, I owe you, you know, my enlightened judgment and my conscience. And he's using a lot of kind of Enlightenment words, and reason and science. I mean, those things do make it feel different. There's even just the tone and the sort of,
well,
the flavour of it feels a little bit different than, let's say, the ferment of ideas in the early 16th century.
Okay, so they're not using the word science, and certainly not in English, because the word science doesn't take on the meaning that it does until the late 19th century. And I think that there is a tendency, which is to kind of identify the sense of a war between religion and science, which emerges in the late 19th century, back onto the 18th century. And undoubtedly that's the case, because Voltaire, again, in particular, is brilliant at picking on, say, Galileo. He enshrines Galileo as an example of an enlightened figure who is silenced by a repressive apparatus of the Catholic Church. And so this gets reconstructed in the late 19th century as an example of this kind of timeless war between religion and science. But it's not that those categories are not seen as mutually opposed in quite the same way that they.
So there's maybe an argument that Enlightenment has slightly been invented by Victorian writers, do you think?
I think absolutely. I think our modern understanding, the 21st century, is one that's been massively mediated by what's gone between the 18th century and now.
Okay. That all sounds fair.
But reason, reason. So it's often, again, the Enlightenment is often described as the age of reason.
Yes.
But that's a very old-fashioned way of seeing it. And the relationship of, you know, the leading Enlightenment figures to reason is incredibly ambivalent and contested. You know, so Kant's great work is the critique of pure reason. Hume famously says that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions.
Well, so this raises an interesting question about the difference between continental Enlightenment and, let's say, an Anglo-Saxon Enlightenment. So there's always been this idea that the continental, you know, which people like me love to trade in, that the continental Enlightenment is all about sort of airy-fairy abstractions and mad utopian ideas, and that the Anglo-Saxon Enlightenment, if there is such a thing, is all about being sceptical and empirical and rooted in kind of, you know, common sense, Dr. Johnson kicking his rock or whatever and saying that he's therefore proved matter exists, and all this sort of stuff. Do you think there is a difference? Do you think that there is a kind of Anglo-Saxon exceptionalism going on, and that, you know, the French are talking about one thing and we're talking about something different?
So I think the fundamental division is not between, say, Britain and the continent, but between essentially Protestant countries and Catholic countries.
Right.
So I think that, say, in England, in Scotland, in the Dutch Republic, by and large, although there are exceptions, Spinoza being the most obvious, the process of enlightenment is conservative. It tends to go with the grain of the establishment. It doesn't aim to overthrow it. I think in France, a Catholic country, the leading figures of the Enlightenment are much more confrontational.
Yeah, I was about to say they're spikier, aren't they? Something like Voltaire.
Or Diderot, you know, who kind of writes the encyclopedie.
That was most beautiful French. That was like Peter Sellers doing Antoine Clouseau.
I know. Well, I was about to pronounce it in the English way, and I suddenly was slamming on the brakes.
Chief Inspector Diderot.
Chief Inspector Diderot. So Diderot is an overt atheist.
Yeah.
Voltaire, I mean, vehemently detests Christianity. I mean, he famously says that, you know, if God didn't exist, we'd have to invent him. Mm. And he he expresses it in a way that you would, I'm sure, entirely approve. It would confirm your darker suspicions of the snobbery of French intellectuals. Yeah. And he says that, you know, he doesn't believe in Christian nonsense, but he wants his, you know, his tailor, his servants and his wife to believe in God, because otherwise he'll be cheated or cuckolded.
That's so Virginia Woolf, isn't it?
Yes. So, and of course, you know, Voltaire has this famous letter that he writes in 1764, where he kind of predicts that the Enlightenment, the blaze of the Enlightenment, will kind of create a great ferment, and that you know, the younger generations are incredibly lucky because they're going to see great things, amazing things are going to happen, and Voltaire and Diderot, we cannot help but now see them in the context of the revolution.
French Revolution. That's going to come. But that's that idea, isn't it? That they are more radical and more abstract and more idealistic, and that Protestant thinkers tend to be more conservative. But for example, historians like Roy Porter say, but that's because the Enlightenment has been successful in, let's say, Britain, that it's embedded, that kind of thinking is embedded in kind of political circles, in Whiggish circles. And so they don't have to be confrontational. So right. People like, you know, I was just trying to think of, you know, you think of some of the great figures. I mean, Jonathan Swift, Edward Gibbon, Burke, but Hume, Locke, Hobbes. You know, there's a great list of British Enlightenment thinkers, Adam Smith, all the Scottish.
Well, you
thinkers.
Say British. I mean, I think the Scottish and the English Enlightenments are
a bit different.
Very distinctive. So if we just look specifically, question from Michael Taylor, great historian, friend of the show. He asks, Scotland had an Enlightenment, but did England?
Well, Scotland, okay, so this, I have a very firm answer to this, Tom. Scotland
Do you,
has a,
Dr.
understandably,
Johnson.
Scotland understandably has a very strong sense of having had an Enlightenment, and absolutely rightly so. You know, people like Adam Smith are, you know, some of the great thinkers of early modern Western sort of culture. And it's understandable that a small country like Scotland, especially one that now in the 21st century that is becoming much more seeing itself as distinct from England, is very keen to celebrate that. England never talks about having an English Enlightenment, but that doesn't mean that there weren't English enlightened thinkers. So of course there were. I mean, I mentioned Gibbon. Dr. Johnson is nothing if not an Enlightenment figure, with his dictionary and his club and all that sort of carry-on. I mean, I think it's undeniable that England has an Enlightenment, but because there's less to kick against, because they're not kicking against the grain, because they are going with the grain, there's less of a sense of them as a movement, because they don't have to have that sense, because they're not outsiders. They're part of the establishment.
But isn't it also, because and the English say this throughout the 18th century with a tone of immense smugness, which I'm now going to repeat.
Yeah, do.
Basically, the kind of the key, you know, the people that people in the Enlightenment look back to, and this absolutely includes French philosophes, Voltaire, you know, preeminently, are looking to figures of the English 17th century. So Bacon,
method, exactly.
Newton.
Yeah, massive.
Locke, all of them. Absolutely massive figures that get enshrined by 18th century
Shakespeare
thinkers.
Voltaire was obsessed with Shakespeare.
Yeah, but Shakespeare is different, because Shakespeare is kind of, you know, is condemned for not obeying the kind of classical regularities. But Bacon, Newton, and Locke are all massive figures. And then you have the Glorious Revolution, which, you know, you can debate. I mean, the views in Scotland and Ireland on how glorious it is would be contested. But in England, it comes to bed down, and it embeds an idea of the English Constitution.
Yeah, which of course
as one that kind of enables enlightened values to flourish.
Yeah,
and so a crucial part of the 18th century Enlightenment is Anglomania. It's a kind of looking to England as an absolute model.
I completely agree with you, Tom. I think so. If you see one of the great creations of the Enlightenment is the American Constitution and the American Republic itself, then that is informed by the ideas of the French thinker Montesquieu, the idea of the separation of powers and so on. And he thought he'd got that from Britain, from the English model. I mean, he was wrong. He slightly misunderstood the English model. But his Anglomania was what he then transported back.
Anglomanie.
Anglomanie. Very good, Inspector Clouseau. Right. I think,
on that patriotic note, we should go to a break.
Should you go and practice your French, and then we'll reconvene and shed some more light on the world of darkness and superstition after the break.
A bientôt.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. We are talking the Enlightenment. And when we left, we were being very patriotic, Dominic. So
it's
I think
very
we should,
unusual, very unusual
we should slightly, we should allow the clouds slightly to blot out the blaze of the sun and go and begin with a question from Native Classicist.
Yeah.
Who writes, as a Native American, I was only aware of Thomas Jefferson calling us merciless Indian savages. Listening to Gibbons, The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, on audiobook, he describes countless peoples as savages. Can you discuss the 18th century European mindset? So this feeds in very well to a kind of sense that is also very popular at the present. You know, there are people who enshrine the Enlightenment as absolutely the seedbed of liberalism and everything. But also there are those who argue that it essentially has created all that's the worst in the modern world, that it's underpinned Western colonialism and racism.
Scientific
and
racism. Kinds of, yeah.
So what's your take on that?
Well, the Enlightenment clearly coincides with the, you know, the great peak of the slave trade, doesn't it? And there's no doubt that there was always a darker side to the Enlightenment, as there is a dark side to all ages. I mean, I don't think that necessarily means the Enlightenment is uniquely depraved. But I think it's certainly true that the you know, when you think about scientific racism, for example, the idea that the world is divided into different, humanity is divided into different races, some with different achievements, different accomplishments and so on, that are innate. That obviously is informed by an age that loves to classify and loves to divide things up and label them. And is also an age in which a lot of these people and their associates are making tons of money from the triangular trade with the colonies. So I think that side of it is undoubtedly there. And there is undoubtedly, I mean, I'm sure you all have a lot to say about this, that there is this obsession, an absolute fascination with the idea of the savage. And you see that in Robinson Crusoe. You see that in Rousseau, the idea of the noble savage, people in a state of nature. They are absolutely obsessed with this idea, with the tension between civilization and barbarism or savagery. And I think Gibbon writing about all that in The Decline and Fall, I mean, that is merely one example of, you know, a huge sort of range of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the ways in which, say, Voltaire or Hume, both of whom are some of the more radical enemies of Christianity, one of the ways in which they're able to liberate themselves from the heritage of Christianity is that they don't feel the need to subscribe to the Genesis story, the idea that all humans have descended from Adam and Eve and therefore have one single source. So Voltaire in particular is a great enthusiast of the idea of polygenesis, the idea that different races have emerged at different points of time. And that, of course, I mean, he's pretty racist. He is able to kind of rank races according to ability. And it seems that Hume does the same. I mean, there's this kind of controversy over Hume that
he's been cancelled.
Yeah, he's been cancelled by Edinburgh University. I mean, he was the great, he's the titanic figure in the Scottish Enlightenment.
I mean, what you would say in their defense is they don't know where that racism is going to lead.
Not.
But at the same time, you would, in the prosecutors would say, but they do know that the trade in slaves is going on.
Yeah, but so Hume is not in favor of the slave trade, and it's unclear why he says, Africans are inferior to white people. And he seems to, it's unclear why he thinks that, but he particularly did think that. And I think that, I would imagine that what underlies it is, as I say, that he doesn't feel any obligation to hold this idea that all human beings are essentially
Created
in the image of God. On the specifics of Native Americans, actually, a lot of the Enlightenment figures are very hostile to European colonialism. They regard it as very pernicious. You have William Robertson, again, one of the great figures of the Scottish Enlightenment, historian who writes History of the Americas. And he brilliantly he describes the Aztecs and the Incas as polished nations, which is the highest praise that any figure in the Enlightenment can offer.
Right.
If you're a polished nation, I mean, that's absolutely the best. And he describes the Native Americans as being like the ancient Britons. So the key there is that, he's not in favor of savagery. And Gibbon does the same. I mean, Gibbon has great fun in describing, say, the Scots as being cannibals and utter savages.
Yeah.
But he's doing it in the full consciousness that Scotland is now, the great center of Enlightenment.
Yeah.
So the philosopher, with the exception of Rousseau, tend not to be in favor of people they would describe as savages. But I think most of them see, this is part of the kind of the Enlightenment universalism that everyone can become enlightened. And as examples of that, they would show the development of, say, Britons from the savagery of the Roman period to the enlightened, polished state of Britain in the 18th century.
Yeah. Although this is then quite different, isn't it, from Rousseau? Rousseau deplores what he sees as kind of, what's he called, a civil man or something like that. He thinks very badly of the kind of process of civilization. He thinks we should get back to a kind of state of grace that we're born in before civilization has had its corrupting effect. So he's the man that you associate more than anybody else with the idea of the noble savage, don't you?
Well, that kind of, in one sense, goes back to Locke, who argues that, there are no innate ideas, that each human being is a kind of tabula rasa, a blank
That's
slate.
Right. Yes.
And
Locke is also a human rights man, isn't he? The idea of inalienable human rights.
But also this is and get ready with your drinking game. This is also framed by a kind of Christian argument that goes.
I thought it was
back.
Going to be cricket. I thought it no, was going to be not, cricket. And it wasn't
because there's this argument between Augustine and Pelagius, in the fourth or fifth century, about whether are humans fallen? Are they naturally evil?
Yeah.
Is there a kind of taint of sin, or are they naturally good? And Pelagius argues they're naturally good. Augustine argues, no, we're all steeped in sin. And it's the Augustinian vision that wins out. I think a crucial part of the Enlightenment is a reaction against that and a kind of return to the Pelagian idea that actually we are naturally good.
Yes.
So Rousseau famously, man is born free. Everyone is in chains. But you get it with Diderot as well, who argues that humans are not naturally evil, that it's bad education, it's pressures in society, it's evil laws that serve to corrupt us. And that's absolutely, that's clearly a crucial part of what feeds into modern political argument. I mean, there's a kind of buried argument there between Augustine and Pelagius, between, I guess it would be kind of Rousseau and Hobbes, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it is Rousseau versus Hobbes. There. Life is nasty, brutish and short versus, you know, let's all be kind.
But of course, famously, you would love this. Rousseau is an absolute horror.
I've actually dug out. Do you know what Diderot said about Rousseau? Yeah. False, as vain as Satan, ungrateful, cruel, hypocritical and wicked. He sucked ideas from me, used them himself and then affected to despise me. Let's hope I never say that about you, Tom.
Yeah. It'd be a horror, wouldn't it? So Rousseau, I mean, but by and large, you know, we talked about the philosophical, the Enlightenment figures are fun. I mean, they're kind of entertaining people to be with. Rousseau is not. So he goes to stay with Hume, and Hume is a famously charming man. I mean, he's great company. Everybody loves Hume, even people who are, you know, shocked by his atheistical views. But Rousseau and Hume, you know, even Hume couldn't get on with Rousseau.
But Rousseau is troubled, isn't he? Because he has a dreadful problem about going to the toilet.
Yes.
Did you know this? He has some issue.
I did.
It's kind of a bit unclear. Is it that he can't go and therefore he is storing up vast quantities of urine and that makes him very uncomfortable and so he doesn't go out or something? Is that what it is?
Well, what I do know is that Boswell, the biographer of Dr. Johnson, he goes on a tour and he goes to visit Rousseau, and Rousseau is always trying to get away from him by going on the toilet.
Right.
And Boswell follows him into the toilet on several occasions.
And what happens? What's going on in there?
Exactly. What's happening?
Yeah.
Also, Diderot. Do you know what Diderot blamed the greatest cause of flatulence on?
Rousseau?
the potato.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, the potato, I suppose, is a relative novelty. Probably, say, he was not a fish and chips man, clearly.
No, absolutely not. Anyway, listen, we mustn't get into...
let's do some questions. Let's do...
Into poo.
So let's do Jeff. Jeff, let's do Jeff and caffeine. Jeff says, what's the role of caffeine in the era's narrative? Do you want to answer that, Tom? What is the role of caffeine?
No, I think you should answer that. That's very much you.
I think it's very important. And I think, actually, if you put England back into the story, England and Holland, I suppose, back into the story of the Enlightenment, from which they're often left out, then caffeine looms very large. Because, of course, coffee houses are one of the sort of paradigmatic public spaces, where people are getting information,
yes,
reading newspapers, they're swapping ideas. So caffeine absolutely matters.
I think particularly in England. I think in Scotland, it's the universities that are the powerhouses of,
yes,
of the Enlightenment. And I think in France, it's the court, particularly the court of Frederick the Great, where Voltaire goes. And then they have spectacular bust up and he has to leave. So I think it's courts, universities and coffee houses,
and they're different in each country.
Yeah.
I think that's absolutely right. So Gordon Smith asked about Scotland, the Scottish Enlightenment. Where has it come from? Why has it come from such a small country? Well, you've kind of answered that, haven't you, Tom? I mean, Scotland is a small country, but it's also part of a much bigger enterprise at this point. So Scotland's in the cities are enjoying massive economic growth, but as you said, the universities are absolutely crucial to the Scottish Enlightenment, aren't they?
Yeah, unlike England, where we only have Oxford and Cambridge, which are at their most kind of port-soaked.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. That's just sort of old clergymen contemplating the meaninglessness kind of life in there.
Snuff-stained waistcoats, dusty wigs. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what was it? Good, brilliant. So we've solved the causes of the Scottish Enlightenment there.
Pat Roberts, is it possible to have a good drama about the Enlightenment? When compared with Tudors and Nazis, it's just blokes in a room writing books. Well, that's a very glamorous pastime, I would say. E.g., Pat Roberts mentions Amadeus, Barry Lyndon, The Great on TV, A Royal Affair about Enlightened Absolutism in Denmark. I'm not aware of that series or film or whatever, but could you have a...
The Great, have you seen The Great?
No, it's Catherine the Great, isn't it?
Catherine the Great.
Is it good? Is it great?
I think it's hilarious. I mean, it has absolutely tangential relationship to...
Right.
I mean, it's more like Blackadder than it is Barry Lyndon. But it's very funny. There was a very funny episode where... Was it actually Voltaire? Completely ahistorically turns up and is... Catherine the Great is all over and then decides he's very boring.
And sends him away.
Yeah.
Is he played by a comedy Frenchman?
I can't remember.
I'd love if they got Gerard Depardieu to play him.
No, he's too large.
Yeah, but that would be the joke there, wouldn't it? he'd be completely wrong. What about John Adams? Have you seen John Adams? That's a brilliant series and very enlightened. I mean, he's a very enlightened figure, as are Jefferson and Franklin and all the other people that crop up in the series. Have you seen that, Tom?
No, I haven't.
Paul Giamatti is John Adams, and he's very good. So, but if you haven't seen it, there's no point talking about it.
But what I would like to say about Franklin, inventor of the lightning rod.
Yeah.
But there was another inventor of the lightning rod who was a Czech Catholic priest.
Was there? So Benjamin Franklin he's done a bit of a Russo. He's sucked.
No, he hasn't stolen it. But it's kind of interesting that one of them, you know, is enshrined as a...
Yes, of course.
A kind of model of progress, whereas the fact that there was a Czech Catholic priest is slightly buried.
Okay. Yeah, well, the faith generally gets written out of this. I mean, I don't want to set you off again, but...
No, you will set me off.
But faith generally gets written out of this story, doesn't it? Because a lot of these people are fascinated by religion. Some of them are very religious themselves. Newton,
most of them
famously.
Are. I mean, the atheists are an absolute minority.
But that kind of gets suppressed. And yeah. So all people now do is talk about atheists and deism and that other side of things.
Deism, by definition, isn't atheism.
Yeah, of course. Okay, how about Lloyd? Now, Lloyd asks what I would call the John Gray question. Brilliant thinker, John Gray, essayist for The New Statesman. He says, while Western liberalism is often described as part of an Enlightenment project, how much can we say that the competitor ideologies of communism or fascism are also Enlightenment projects? And of course, the thinker John Gray would say they absolutely are. They are the kind of logical development of Enlightenment ideas about reason and the general will and these kinds of things. So what do you think about communism and fascism, Tom? Enlightenment projects?
Well, you know, because we've done episodes on them.
Yeah.
So, and you know that I would trace its origins much further back than the Enlightenment.
Would you? I would say they are Enlightenment. Certainly communism is an Enlightenment project, isn't it? Post-Enlightenment project?
No, it's a post-Christian project.
Post-Christian, of course. That's another drink on, that's another tick on the bingo card.
And talking of which, Diogo Morgado,
yes,
does the Muslim world need a kind of Enlightenment today? The power of the religion in everyday life is staggering, something that isn't seen in the West.
I think you should answer that question.
Okay, I think that's a really interesting question. We're planning to do an episode on Napoleon in Egypt, which is really, it's a fascinating episode because you talked about Napoleon as an Enlightenment despot. It's the first meeting between the Enlightenment and the world of Islam. What I think that question highlights, and I think that the episode of Napoleon in Egypt definitely does, is the degree to which, as has been said throughout, the Enlightenment is a very culturally contingent phenomenon. It's rooted in the specifics of Western Europe and specifically in deeply rooted Christian assumptions. And it's when it comes up against, say, a civilization as rich and complex and ancient as the Muslim world that you come to recognize that. And today you see that people often talk about the Enlightenment values in the context of Islam.
Yeah.
You say, I'm a defender of the Enlightenment values, and that therefore entitles me to draw cartoons of Muhammad or whatever, or pose the veil or something like that. And it highlights the way in which the Enlightenment, like Islam and like the Christianity that it emerges from, is universalist in its scope.
Yeah, of course it is. People talk about exporting Enlightenment values, don't they?
Absolutely. And so that thing that I said, you know, where Voltaire is sneering at the Church Fathers because they want to convert the whole world to their way of thinking, that's exactly what the Enlightenment is all about. And so therefore, what do you do with something like Islam that is similarly universalist, you know, similarly rich and complex? It's very indigestible. And really, if you're an enlightener, if you're an enthusiast for the Enlightenment, then of course you think that the Muslim world should have an Enlightenment in exactly the same way that if you're a devout Christian, you think that Muslims should become Christian. Or indeed, if you're a Muslim, you think that the rest of the world should become Muslim. And, you know, we still live in the 21st century in this kind of tension between the rival universalisms of what we used to call Christendom and the Muslim world.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with that, Tom. I think the key thing is defenders of the or self-declared enthusiasts for the Enlightenment often don't accept and don't see what I think you rightly say, that the Enlightenment is itself culturally contingent. that it's based on a, comes out of a particular world at a particular place and time, and that its claims to universal human values are themselves rooted in something. And it's as though they can't see that that is itself, you know, a universalizing project, just as you say. And, you know, that sort of thing of like, let's go to Afghanistan, let's go to Iraq with our copies of Candide. we're doing it in the name of universal human rights.
Yeah.
I sort of think, well, why can't you see why to them, to the people you're claiming to convert, you're just a bunch of Western, you know, colonizers?
There's a very funny episode where Voltaire, who's a great enthusiast for China, which he sees as a kind of enlightened despotism that should be a model for Europeans and doesn't have Christianity and therefore is highly to be applauded. But he knows nothing about China whatsoever. And then he meets with a Jesuit who's been in China, who's been at the imperial court, and corrects him on his, you know, misapprehensions. So Voltaire has a massive strop about this and starts enshrining India as the model of enlightenment.
That's funny. Has he been to India? No, of course not.
No.
Knows
nothing about it at all. So he's basically, Voltaire's a great enthusiast for projecting his idea of what, of how a state should be organized. Say, what is his watch, you know, in China or India or whatever.
That's funny.
I think have we done the enlightenment now?
There's one more question which somebody asked online. I've forgotten who it is. I'm terribly sorry if this is your question, but I thought it was fascinating about Freemasonry and about Freemasonry and the Enlightenment. And so many of these people were Freemasons. Voltaire was a Freemason. Montesquieu was a Freemason. Diderot, Goethe, Mozart, Benjamin Franklin, who you talked about, was a very keen Freemason. And of course, Masonic imagery appears on, you know, the dollar and in sort of the American Republican, the iconography of the American Republic. And I think Freemasonry was absolutely central to the Enlightenment. I mean, a Masonic lodge was like the sort of Soho House, the trendy private members club of the Enlightened world. So Masonic lodges would be established all over Europe. And again, it's something that starts in Scotland and in England, which sort of reinforces that point that we always think of the Enlightenment as continental, but that all these people basically belong to Anglo-Scottish clubs, which are their Masonic lodges.
So are you basically saying the Enlightenment is essentially British?
It's British Masonic conspiracy. I think that's what I'm basically saying.
I think it's a splendid note, patriotic note on which to end.
It is indeed. But I tell you what we should do though, Tom, which we haven't done, which we said we would do. Who's your favourite and least favourite Enlightenment thinkers?
I'm very fond of Diderot.
What, because you like encyclopedias?
He was a very kind, brilliant, generous man. I think the scale of his kind of intellectual inquiries is just phenomenal. I think he is a contradiction to the idea that the Enlightenment was just about classifying and splitting and dividing. He was fascinated by the gaps, by the kind of areas where things didn't quite fit. So he's very, very sophisticated. And he was very fond of beavers. the furry kind.
Right.
And he was reduced to tears by the way that the beavers were being wiped out by trappers in North America. And he said, How can people persecute this gentle, appealing, pitiable animal? And I think that's the Enlightenment at its absolute best.
Well, I can't improve on that, actually. I'm just not going to say anything other than...
Okay. Well, I tell you what, you can come in with your worst. Who's your...
Oh, my worst is Rousseau, obviously. I think Rousseau is a terrible man. I mean, we've sort of advertised how bad Rousseau was. Edmund Burke. I didn't mention Edmund Burke on Rousseau. Burke, obviously, a great product in the Enlightenment, one of my favourite Enlightenment thinkers. Burke said of Rousseau, he entertained no principle but vanity. With this vice, he was possessed to a degree little short of madness. And obviously, you know, Rousseau slightly. If I was Rousseau, I would be looking at the French Revolution and thinking, you know, doesn't look great for me. My reputation. You know, where did I go wrong? But of course, Rousseau was so vain that he would never have done that.
He was a terrible father as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's just a terrible man. That business about separating kids from their parents and educating them and, you know, all that stuff.
He's very much the kind of the ancestor of the kind of person on Twitter who says, be kind.
Be kind.
And then you find, that they're behaving appallingly.
Yeah. They say be kind, and then you find they've written to your employer to get you sacked. Yeah. Yes. That's exactly who Rousseau is. Yeah. I can think of so many real current 21st century Rousseaus, but I'm not going to name them because I don't want to end up in a libel court. And so on that note, I think we really should end. Don't you, Tom?
Yeah.
I think we've brought enormous light to this murky.
We really have.
To this murky topic. And nobody ever need talk about the Enlightenment again because we've done it.
Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let the rest of history be and always light. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.